Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren. Sitting co-host today would be the great Brian Turnoff.
Just a sausage link away.
Just a sausage link. His sausage is a real turnoff. Oh. And, you know, the third person in the room is a guy that co-hosts quite a bit. And he's got a book out. So it's important that we talk to him about his book because he's a good writer.
Yeah.
So you have to state that.
So it's Mr. John Copenhaver.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Doing good.
I guess my sausage isn't so good, but
oh dear.
So your new book, The Savage Kind, mm-hmm. A Mystery.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I will say one thing. I was surprised when you were starting to talk about this book just mm-hmm. a while back, because you don't really mention what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're not real open about it. All of a sudden, you've got, you know, the covers are coming out and all this, and it's like, wow, where did that come from?
So, surprise.
Do you have to write that way? Do you, like, keep it real close to you and not really talk to people about it? Or are you worried that we were going to steal your idea?
Oh, well, no, not the latter. I think that sometimes it's just, I mean, honestly, it takes a lot of energy to talk about your writing when, particularly when it's processed, because it's still very much like, even when you're editing it, I think it's still very much processing through your brain, you know? And sometimes you just, it's like trying to unscramble it all, for people. You know, I think I really start talking about a book when I feel like I've sort of sent it off to, you know, start, you know, in the true kind of publishing process. I've gone through the edits of, I'm kind of letting it go. And then I can really start talking about it more objectively. But I think that's kind of what it is. And also I'm kind of like, I'm not one of those guys that's like, hey, you want to hear about my book? I think that it kind of has to become part of a conversation.
It seemed like it was just a surprise. And then all of a sudden the emails come out, man, you get plastered with the stuff. the email and that's it. You're wearing a hat, you know.
I guess, Wearing a hat?
Yeah, the agent sent it to me. I don't know. You know,
just, yeah. Wearing a hat.
What was I wearing a hat?
Well, you know, it was an old style hat too. So.
Oh, you're talking probably my website is what you're thinking of, where I have like the fedora on with the sort of mystery.
Yeah. But it came in. I got it in an email.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I'll send maybe. It to you.
There's all sorts of pictures.
Some of it is my newsletter that I do because this is what authors are told that they need to do, is to keep a monthly mine is not monthly at all because I don't have that much news. But, you know, when a book is coming out, it's true. My book is coming out, you know, it is like you're building an audience. And, you know, a lot of the research shows that you build an audience by keeping sort of contact with them via newsletter. So you start, you know, you start building that and figuring out how to do a newsletter, which is not very natural, but it's, yes, it does something that a lot of authors do and are told to do.
Well, I got the next topic already for you. Apparently there are some pictures circulating around the web that you're unaware of. That Al has put out there with this fedora. So, you know, that one may be the next one for you. So.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
it's Photoshop.
Go on the black, you know, the dark interwebs or and all that.
Yeah.
Well, as long as I look good, it's fine. No, I'm fine.
Well, there you
Who
go.
Who doesn't in a fedora?
So, right.
Yeah. No one's going to be looking at the hat. Come on. But I have to wonder, in your particular case.
Right.
I think that you take things fairly serious when it comes to your books.
Oh, yeah, I do.
And you care a lot about reaction, what people think. And so I would imagine that would be some of your attention. So you've got to keep it separate, the whole promoting part, rather than during your writing. Because during your writing, if you're focused on all of that, wouldn't it interfere, right?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I'll tell you a little story about that because I think it is really related to this book. So my first book, Dodging and Burning, it was a long journey to find my publisher, Pegasus. In fact, the longest part of the process after the writing of it wasn't finding my agent, it was finding my publisher. In the meantime, I wrote an older version of The Savage Kind. And I wrote it in this space of kind of feeling rejection because I wasn't sure what was going to happen with Dodging and Burning. And I thought I may very well have to lead with this, you know, the second book that I wrote. Honestly, it was a version of the book that I was really writing for an imagined audience and not for myself. And I don't think it was very good. I had to go back in and completely reimagine it. And, you know, between like the first version of it and then the reimagining of it, I saw Dodging and Burning. And so my perspective on my writing really changed. My confidence changed. I realized, you know, Dodging and Burning, which is a book I certainly wrote for myself. And when I say for myself, I don't necessarily mean I wasn't unaware of an audience, but, you know, I think that ultimately I just wrote it in a more sort of pure way. And then like this first version of The Savage Kind, I didn't. And so once I got that confidence again, I was able to rewrite, reimagine, and do what I had really, I think, set out to do with Savage Kind. But I had to let that kind of fear of my audience or that worry that somehow I need to write a kind of book for to sell it. You know what I mean? And I think other writers are different. I write better if I write the book that I want to read. And then just figure it out from there. When I was trying to write this older version of my book, I don't think it was working because I was trying to, you know, sell it and when I was writing it. And you're right. You can't, for me, I don't want to put this on other people. It's better if I separate the two, the promotional side from the writing side.
Yeah, that makes more sense anyway. Mm-hmm. So now this one, you've got two characters, two girls. And how do you choose these names?
What, Philippa and Judy?
Yeah, Judy Peabody was like, okay, she's a nerd, right? You can, I mean, with a name
or
like
is
that.
She?
Well, that's, you know, that's it, right? And then...
seriously, judging a book by its cover, like, literally right now.
Well, no, but you see, consciously you choose these names
to
create an image.
Very specifically.
Right? So in a way, you're choosing these names to make me think or try to imagine who these characters are, right?
Sure.
As I'm reading. So you must have something in mind when you choose these names.
Yeah.
Or I could be wrong. You see, because again, you're writing fiction, so you create these two characters. And so you must have something in your mind of what they're going to look like and what kind of personality they're going to have. So with that being said, the names got to match. It sounds weird, but names have got to match.
They do, absolutely, 100%.
And then you've got, and I go through this, and then so all of a sudden there's newfound feelings toward each other.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God! So, so this is one of those complex stories that you're following their relationship and how they meet and go along as they go through solving a crime, basically.
Yeah. I really like the double task of. And then sometimes it drives me crazy, but I really like the double task of, developing characters over a sort of plot that is, complex. So, the arc of their relationship, the arc of their personalities is wedded to the plot while also being a mystery plot. and because I like character and I like plot as a reader. And I think that, I don't think, readers should have to choose between those two things, if that's what they want. So you've got, I have these two characters who are both dealing with their sexuality, dealing with various, childhood traumas in very different ways. And then trying to figure out what happened to a classmate of theirs and most importantly, their beloved English teacher who they idolize, Miss Martins. And so, it's like kind of, you're just balancing a lot, but I like that. I mean, I like that because I think I care equally about those things. So, and you're right. The names are just super important. And there's a story behind every name, but I think that, I think you kind of have to have that story and it also has to have the right feel for the character. So.
And to piggyback on Al's question, what about like 1940s DC? Cause I think not just for this book, but at least part of the last book, first book, I think takes a place there. I mean, what about that time and place that draws you there as inspiration for your plot?
Yeah, well, lots of things, actually. I think that it's a fascinating time period historically. And the more I realize this, the more I'm really writing about post-war, the environment, not so much during the war. I mean, although some of that stuff does come up in Dodging and Burning, this novel's completely post-war. I think because it's this time period of a lot of turmoil, but also a lot of, in the 40s were sort of more loosening of social mores and social moral, that kind of like judgmental ways of looking at differences in people. And then in the 1950s, it all kind of closes down. And so, we get a very conservative time period. We get the McCarthy era. We get, it's one of the worst times to be gay in sort of the 20th century was the 1950s. Women, the choices for women and what they could do with their lives and sort of their identities was closing down too. So it's sort of this moment right before the storm. And that fascinates me as well. I also just love a lot of kind of writing and film from that time period. I love film noir. I love the sort of the moral questions and ambiguities that often come up in really in the really great, you know, films of that time period that were, you know, detective films or film noir in general. So I think there's like lots of reasons drawing me to that. In a weird way, also in a really personal way, it's my mom's era. She was exactly Philippa and Judy's age at that time. So sort of interesting to think about her story. I mean, it's not her story, but, it, you know, to think about sort of women of her generation and kind of what they lived through.
Well, so how do you get yourself into the character of someone in the 1940s? Are you like going out and buying secondhand clothes from the 40s and dressing up and sitting in your bed?
Well, that was his real life inspiration, obviously.
Oh, right. That's hence the fedora.
Oh,
back when men wore hats. No, I think. I mean, with Donnie and Bernie, I actually did go out and buy a 1940s outfit, but for my friends who were posing for the photograph for that one. But generally, I really watch a lot of popular entertainment from that time period. I read from that time period. I do research, of course, but I think it's more important kind of finding the primary text that I think kind of flesh out the way people saw themselves then. You also have to realize, and this is an interesting thing to balance, is that, you know, when you're like, say, watching a film noir from that time period, you're not getting actually how people spoke and behaved. You get a very edited, stylized version of that. But so often the way we remember that time period is through the art and from that time period. So when you're writing, you have to take in consideration maybe how it was, but also people's expectation or their sort of collective memory of that time period, which is a slightly different thing. So it's when you're sitting down to figure out how to write that on the page, there has to be some that, you know, nods and is in conversation with like the actual time period itself, and then also the art from the time period, like the movies and stuff. So, and I always find myself pulling back in the dialogue. I'm like, this dialogue sounds a little bit too much like, you know, snappy 1940s film dialogue, and doesn't quite have the, you know, 21st century realism to it. But, you know, you also want to nod a little bit to the time period in the dialogue. So there's sort of this, you're walking in this tightrope a little bit.
You have to have at least three of the characters say, "Meh, copper."
Exactly.
But I would also think that isn't it in a way a little bit restrictive? Because you're talking about 17-year-old girls in the 1940s. So yeah. Their awareness would not be what it is of a 17-year-old girl in 2020.
So
on how you develop them, like how they act and react to, let's say, a relationship with each other in 1940 is going to be a totally different thought of two girls at 17 in 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So isn't that a little bit restrictive? Like, do you find it a little bit like you can't go, you know, 2020 wild with these two girls?
No, well, I mean, they don't have the language. I mean, they don't have the language. They do have the feelings. So, right. You know, what you're really left with is, and there are, they do have some awareness of same-sex attraction. Unfortunately, during the time period, it would have been all negative, right? It's all, you know, if you're gay, you're a deviant, or you're, you know, psychologically unwell. Like, those were the options. And that they would have had any sort of access to the time period for understanding their feelings. And so they have to figure out sort of how they feel about it and how they navigate the negativity that the world, you know, is they have some, you know, some clue about, but they don't really have a positive language for it. And it causes a lot of, you know, of course, internal struggle too. But, you know, I think that's interesting to write about because I think people do forget that it wasn't you know, it's easy to be out and to talk about same-sex attraction. You couldn't flick on popular entertainment and see a, you know, a same-sex couple on Netflix or some story. I mean, it's happening now. It really is fairly recent. But still, I get people, of course, responding to Dodging Burning, my first book, which had similar themes. They were sure shocked about how bad it was. I was like, well, but it was, you know. and so I think that sometimes, I guess, when the limitations are what interests me. I think that you can do interesting and sort of expose that and find a way, like kind of, and in some ways it's like a mystery plot. It can be kind of limiting too, but it's interesting to play with the form. So I think that's maybe something I'm kind of compelled by a little bit.
You touched on something there a little bit before that, you know, about more representation in fiction. You know, what other parts of the LGBTQ community or aspects would you like incorporated into fiction? Or I guess maybe you want to see some of those like tired old tropes taken away.
Yeah, well, certainly the tired old tropes I would love to see. I'd love to see less of. Some of them because they're negative and some of them because they're just tired. And
you're talking about me.
Like what?
You're talking about me.
Give us some context.
Tired old.
Outside of Alan Moore.
Al's a tired old trope. No.
Wow.
No.
That's a compliment for him, actually.
But. Yeah. Things are going up.
But what else would you like to see more incorporated or less incorporated? Like,
well, I think that, you know, and I'm looking at generally, I think that where it's not necessarily, you know, to be have a character who's gay, a lesbian, or trans character in a story, and they're just in the story functioning like any other character. It's not about their, you know, identity. Not that their identity isn't a part of who they are and that plays in the story, but that the story isn't centering around their same-sex attraction or some sort of strife therein. It's just like, you know, they're, you know, a lawyer who's gay or a detective who's trans or something, and they're solving a crime. I think that it normalizes it, and I think that, you know, that is acceptance ultimately when it's not a big deal anymore and or made a big deal of. So I think anything that allows for that would be wonderful to see. You know, I think that we do have to back off of some of the tired old tropes of the, you know, the gay best friend trope, which still is alive and well. You know, the deviant gay sort of trope, which I think is still out there, like a bad boy, bad actor kind of deal. And I think that just like, or take them and then like twist them and turn them a little bit, deepen them, explore them in a more complex way, which is certainly great to do too. So, you know, in other words, you can, you know, just not write them, or you can write into them and find, you know, depth and complexity into some of those tropes. But, yeah, I think there's certainly progress that we can make. And we are, I think, making. I just hope it continues on an upward trend.
Yeah, it might just take a matter of time, because what we recognize is kind of same old trope, or say the kind of like not a very original character, is not what someone in Alabama might, you know,
it may be the first time they're encountering any kind of
right so character. So for a lot of people, because it seems like the country is not equal in all aspects of understanding or education, so
no,
there might be a lot of people that see it and go, oh wow, and had never realized that gay people are human too.
Yeah.
Newsflash.
Yeah, just throwing that out there. But, you know, but
Or that we're just so much like, I mean, I think there's all this made of the difference, and I think there's so much that's the same, you know, and I think that there's real power in finding, you know, that, you know, the differences aren't as great as you might think.
Well, I was going to say, and then there's like something on the opposite end of the spectrum where, and I don't want to like, hopefully you guys don't get in trouble with this part, but like before we were talking, before leading up to the interview, you both were talking about how you've had some pushback from publishers with particular words that you want to use and include into your books. So, I mean, like, how do you feel about that, where like, even that today still exists?
You know, I think, you know, my publisher has been great.
You have to say that. I apologize.
But no. Well, I'm honestly not just saying it. They have. It's not been an issue. I think that I have in other smaller venues just had some pushback on. I think it's for different reasons. Like, I think for me, it was largely just figuring out what sort of the sensitivity of the audience and making sure that I am, you know, being thoughtful about their sensitivity. I haven't had a situation where I was publishing something and they were like, this is too gay or this is too explicit or this is, but I don't write super explicit stuff. So I don't know if I would be the greatest test for that. But I think that I think there's some understanding that, you know, we are moving beyond that kind of, and that double standard where like the straight, for instance, the straight sex scene goes in, the gay sex scene gets edited out. One's more explicit than the other, but there seems to be a different set of standards if you're gay, and really it's just homophobia. That's what that is. It's not about, you're not caring about sort of people's, you know, sensitivity towards towards, you know, whatever illicit sex. It's about, you know, that you're playing into homophobia, fear of it. So I have not experienced that. I know that a lot of other writers have, in the not present, but in the near past. So I think even recently things are changing a lot, and we're starting to our sensitivities are changing. So it's interesting to see how it develop.
Alan, like, what about you though? Like, what about like for non-sexual aspects of a book or parts of the plot? You were talking about like one word before, I think ghetto. And that was like literally the perfect word that you could use for in that instance. I mean, how do you feel about that?
For me, when I go to a publisher, I go for a reason. And in this particular case, when I go toward a publisher that does true crime or a publisher that's a gay publisher and stuff like that, when I do that, I'm looking for they know what their audience is good and what sells to them, what they like, you know, and how their audience is going to react. So I find it bizarre because.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm old, and I look back at it, and a lot of these words do not seem very offensive to me, right? So for me, it's a shock. But I also understand that they're trying to do a job, and they only want to make the book better. But it is shocking as you get older, and I let them do what they do. As long as it's not a drastic change, it's fine.
Yeah. And also, I think that point about the audience is important. And I think one of the rules that I always feel like you don't want to give a reader a reason to put down a book or put down an article or whatever. You don't want something to be an impediment to the part or the main idea of what you're trying to communicate. And so I just think, you know, getting hung up on a word here or there, essentially the sensitivity readers say this is not good. I think you need to be sensitive and thoughtful and not like impede your process, you know, the process of communicating with your reader, you know, ultimately why do that? And, I think at times you can think about, okay, well, this strikes me as strange because that wasn't, you know, for me or even in my current context, but, you know, once again, like, I'd rather the heart of what I was trying to say get through than worry about a word or two. By the end of the day, you got to look at the big picture. So,
yeah, you both have future in politics for sure.
No, I mean, as being honest in a sense, because what the publisher will do is open you up into a new audience that you might not have. And that's sort of what I look for. So in a way, it's networking yourself and your work. So you learn from it because in a sense you realize that, you know, they know something I don't. So that's sort of why I do that. And, you know, it's not anything drastic. I don't mind a word or two or a phrase or something. I sometimes roll my eyes. I think it's silly. I do. I just think, wow, that's crazy. But I'm also not a 20-year-old in 2020, you know.
Right.
So how the young people see it is just like probably how I saw it back in 1980.
Right. Well, I've certainly had conversations with my mother about words that she uses, and she thinks I'm, you know, she's almost just going to be 90 here in a few weeks. So, you know, I can't be lecturing her if I'm not willing. You know, I mean, I got to be willing to listen too. And yeah. I mean, I work with a lot of young people as well. So, I think you have to, just be willing, I guess, to go with the flow. And I'm always asking questions about them. I think that's fine. I think we should. But I'm also trying to, like, connect and, you know, with people. And if mom's going to put up with me lecturing her, then I need to be put up with a little bit of lecturing myself.
Well, I didn't mean to put you both on the spot there. So, guys, and that's coming from the guy asking the question, is a non-writer, never written anything. So take it with a grain of salt.
I think my point, or what I was getting at, is these two girls, in their mind in the 1940s, would not be, like, thinking this could possibly be a relationship and marriage.
Oh, no, I don't think they would ever think of it in those terms. I think that they would struggle to think of it even in terms of romance.
Right.
Yet there, you know, are feelings that are, and even the way the girls feel towards each other, it's not quite the same feeling they're having. And so it's, you know, what do you do with a feeling that you don't fully understand, but it's, you know, sending a strong message. And oftentimes then when you try to express that feeling, it comes out all wrong, or it comes out the wrong moment. Or the person's just not ready to receive it. And so a lot of that, you know, bears out in the story. And I think it's an ongoing process to navigate. It's, you know, I certainly, I think for these two girls and you know, Philippa and Judy, they're on a journey. And not necessarily one that they reached by the end of the book. I do have two more books planned, so we'll see.
Oh, you're going to use the same characters?
Yeah. So it's book one of a trilogy that I've already outlined. They will see the girls, in the early 1950s again. So a little older, and then in 1963, is the last book. Because it's sort of charting that also the time period as well, and sort of how things changed through those years, sort of the Mad Men years a little bit is what it ends up being. So I'll get to see them sort of grow and then see the choices they make through that time, beyond the book. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about them that way too.
Wow. So you're going to have this long romance going on. Yeah. That must be a struggle for you, but working this out and doing this kind of work, because you're sitting there and you obviously have to be into your characters, and you're writing a lot about the things they're going through emotionally and physically too, but also living your life and, let's say, being at school and working and everything else that you do. It must – do you have a problem, but does it overlap sometimes?
I think I hunger for long stretches of time to write. And, I am not one of those writers who can write on their lunch break or write, 15 minutes in the morning. It takes me about an hour to get up to the point of writing because I have to get back in that world. And I do this to myself to a certain degree, but I put a lot of layers in and I have a lot of plot threads and I insist that they all tie up and are connected in some way. And so one of the reasons that it takes me so long to get back into it is I have to get back to the character's perspective, but also have to know where I am in the story and what, five things are going on at the same moment. So I think that it is difficult. I really love long spans of time to write. And for that reason, I do a lot of my writing. Since I'm a teacher, I do a lot of my writing on breaks. I just have to.
Yeah. Now the actual murder in the book, or not there's quite a few different parts, because there's their teacher as well. And, geez, I don't know how to say this, but so the actual theme of the crime, how do you come up with that? Like, what is it? Do you plan this out ahead of time before the girls came, or is this something that you brought into the girls?
Well, I think both my books have started with sort of a scene or an idea. And in this case, this one started with this idea of these two teenage girls bonding over and romanticizing their very lovely, very poised, and somewhat mysterious English teacher, who in a lot of ways, I think for these girls is an example of who at least they think they want to be. And then to have that, character go through something and, perhaps something traumatic and then have the girls have to wrestle and try to understand that maybe what they're seeing is more complex and layered and, than they had ever thought, that they have to wrestle with that sort of, it's a kind of a coming of age thing where, okay, maybe this person isn't the glamorous person we thought they were, or maybe they're more troubled than we thought they were, or, and so that idea is where that's kind of like the spark. Now where it goes is a lot. There's a lot that it gets, unfurls about, their English teacher and then this death of this classmate who is sort of inexplicably hostile towards both their English teacher and to them. And they don't really have any idea why this guy Cleve, this sort of moody, classmate is decided to, hate them and hate the teacher so much. It up to the point of really being unsettling. And so, like, all this, of course, is, you know, it's bound up in the same issue, which I can't say too much about or I'll spoil it. But, you know, that is kind of where it starts for me. And then I just work it out. I just work it out. I kind of play with it until I figure out what's going on. It's a little bit of an adventure about, you know, what's going on in my subconscious. Like, what am I trying to work out here through a plot and through this scenario? Like, what was it that, where did this idea come from? And it's true. It was true in this book. It was true in the last book. There's a moment where very kind of late in the revision process, I have this big epiphany about what kind of was going on. And then I have to stop and rewrite a bunch of it, which takes a long time. But it's exciting because then you feel like you're on your own sort of journey of self-discovery as well. So, but you'll have to read the book to find out.
Nice teaser.
Well, so when you say that, I guess I'd imagine that you're actually working out some sort of subtext. You're actually working out something you want to get across to people.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think a lot of it has to do with identity and assumptions we make about people. That I think this idea of how we tend to categorize, oversimplify what we think we know about people. In a lot of ways, it's like the writer's journey is to, you know, I would say argue the good writer's journey is to try to convince people that, you know, we're not dealing with cardboard cutout characters. We're dealing with sort of these complex, multi-layered people with lots of, depth and, and it's not all good, right? But it's there. And so I think that it's challenging a lot of ideas. Even like my narrator, who sort of functions as kind of the frame for the journal entries, which is sort of have these dueling journal entries from both the girls' perspectives. But then there's an older narrator who comes in and says, I'm one of these two girls, but I'm not going to tell you which one. And so it's sort of her way of saying, I want you to look at this and see what you see, and without me guiding you. So I don't know. A lot of it is about, I think the message is about identity. It's about finding out ultimately that we may be sort of mysteries to ourselves. In the constant process of, trying to solve our own mysteries, about who we are. I can't say too much more, but I think that like that is part of the mystery, really, is the mystery of self.
I've always wondered what it's like, John, to be the second best co-host on House of Mystery.
it's an honor.
well, clearly you've submitted to the idea because on your Zoom it says John Copenhaver, writer. So you have accepted your fate. But now that you're all big time, you're a huge writer, award winning. I mean, why do you keep coming back and letting Alan use you? Huh? Use your name for free.
I think it's I love this. It's fascinating. It is nothing I could have predicted participating in and doing. I think Al's a great host, and I think we have so many interesting conversations. So it totally applies to me being a writer because I feel like I constantly learning from talking to guests of the show. And so in a lot of ways it feeds me. It's a real kind of privilege to be able to do it. And so I keep coming back and doing it. And
you're really buttering Alan up here. Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, I get why he keeps you here around.
I know. But I do mean it. I mean, I do. It is a cool thing. It's also unexpected. In fact, I mentioned the credits of my book. I'm like, why Al ever thought that I should be on the radio? I have no idea. But here I am.
I always choose people by how they act and then their personality. So, but you know, you've got lots of experience in writing, so
I mean,
it's a good thing. So when you decide something like this, so how well this book does, will that determine whether you write the other two parts or do you write them anyway?
I think it will, yes. I mean, there will be some, you know, connection between that. I sell enough copies of Savage Kind. You know, I think this is a publisher's decision, not mine. I would love to be able to write them, and I hope I get a chance to. But, yeah, I mean, it just depends, really. You know, I think the thing that's really lovely about Pegasus is they're not a big, major publishing house. They're independent. They're pretty robust independent, but they're independent. And I think one of the reasons that they published Dodging and Burning is because they had a more flexible idea of what a mystery could be. And I think that that's true for the Savage Kind as well. And I'm hoping that because of those things, they, you know, they don't expect, you know, great riches to fall from the sky from, you know, from sales of Savage Kind. But I mean, of course I would love that, but I don't anticipate that. And few authors can predict that kind of thing. But I think that they're open to, you know, they want to have a relationship with the writer. It's not just about, well, we sell a bunch of books, one book and make a lot of money. They really want to develop and nurture writers, which is kind of that's an old fashioned idea of how publishers and writers should work. And I think it's a much healthier one. I would love to be able to do, but I can't say that I'm promised this, and we'll see how things go next week when it comes out.
So now, how do you like people to get a hold of you? I mean, what, a website?
Yeah, so my website is www.johncopenhaver.com. And I'm on Instagram at johncope74. And then very easy to find on Twitter and Facebook. It's just John Copenhaver. Find me.
Grindr or anything like that. I have, you know, fans want to know. they want to know. They want
inquiry minds want to know.
Well, they
Brian,
want
Brian
know,
wants Shane. To know. Brian wants to know. That's,
I already know. It's cool.
Yeah.
Where do you think that fedora hat came from?
Yeah. Well, there you go. You see? You know, going on behind my back, all this, everyone's having fun but me, you know? Wow.
And, the fun happens behind your back, obviously.
And Brian, before the interview, is going, well, he's won all these awards. Why would he want to still be on your show?
I don't get it. But now it's making sense.
Are these awards important to you?
Yes, but in a very particular, I think it comes down to what the awards actually mean. And they often can mean different things. And, I think that some mean sort of, you have written a good book and you participate in the community, the writing community. And, in some cases, they're more about like the merit of your own writing. I think you have to look at awards and, you know, be proud of them, but never let them convince you that you're, you know, the stuff, right? You always have to work hard. And so just, you know, I love them. I'm happy to get that recognition, of course, but I think you also have to be, a little critical of yourself and what it actually means in terms of your writing. I think you have to continue to challenge yourself and push yourself. So, I guess that's kind of a general answer for it. But yeah, certainly, it's a good feeling. And it's a good feeling to get that McCavity Award and get up and stand up at BoucherCon and say a few things.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I, nobody, everybody keeps me away from those sort of things. they're, they'd be embarrassed of that, you know. So what would be a surprising thing for your fans to know about you? Like, what would be something that they wouldn't expect? Like, do you, you know, listen to Metallica records, or like, is there like a surprise, or read or listen to something or do something that everybody that knows you as a writer would be like, wow?
Well, I think that the thing that comes to mind that has the strongest relationship with my writing is I am obsessed, and I have been since I was in high school, with film scores. And so I have a huge collection, in fact, boxes and boxes of CDs, remember those, that are full, there are all these film scores, and I still to this day listen to film scores when I write. And I think in a weird way, they are a big part of my writing process. I will actually choose, you know, a track or something if it's like the mood of a scene that I want to get right. And some people have said, you know, you're kind of a cinematic writer, which makes sense because I think that I do plug into it with the film score. So I think that's kind of makes maybe a little different than, you know, I mean, it's not just casual. I mean, I'm pretty deep in the film score. World, this film score subculture.
Well, there you go. A future
what a nerd. For you. Oh my god.
Oh my god. I'm a big I love nerd. It. I love I'm it. A huge nerd. Yeah, undoubtedly. But I don't think anyone's surprised by that.
Newsflash.
Wow. How long does it take you to write one of these books? From start to finish, like not including the edit process, but to get it to them. How long does that take you generally?
Well, Dodging and Burning took about 3 years, and it's so honestly kind of hard to say with A Savage Kind, but probably about 3 years. I hope to speed that up. I think some of it's just because of life stuff going on too, but I'm also not going to be one of those guys that puts out a book every year. I know I'm not. You know, I would love to like pull it back and get it to down to 2 years.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough thing to do. It's tough. Especially, it depends on how busy you are and that. So.
Yeah, well, full-time teaching takes a lot, and so it's hard to do both. But and then, like I said, I decided to write historical fiction, which takes research, and you know, you keep on layering adding the things in, and it just takes longer.
Yeah, it seems to be trendy lately. The historical fiction, there seems to be a lot of those.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's kind of loose dealing with fiction that way. I'm sort of struggling with that idea.
Oh, what, like how you interpret a historical moment or something like that?
Yeah, like, because they'll take a historical event, something around something that's fairly major, and they add a lot of things and characters and drama to the story.
Right.
That's sort of, sometimes it's kind of... I find it unusual sometimes. Sometimes it goes in a place where I don't expect it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you are, I think the problem is if we're, as audience members, not viewing it with some sort of critical mindset. In other words, you're just watching this historical, you know, whatever, this biopic or something, and you're not like, you're thinking that's exactly how it happened, you know?
I mean, I think we can all agree that Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter was clearly the best historical fiction works in the last 30 years, right? I mean,
and he was totally a vampire hunter.
It was so realistic. It really, truly was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people just need to be like, okay, this is an interpretation of a historical moment. And that's fine. I think we're allowed to, in fact, you know, we interpret contemporary life all the time anyway. So Everything's an interpretation. So,
I mean, even history is a real interpretation. Right? Oh, history is written by the winners. So, I mean, that's one way of viewing it too.
It's totally. It's just people think. I mean, the problem is that the way people see history is just this one absolute, and they have an absolute idea about it, and that's a problem because often that absolute idea, there's all this other information they don't have that complicates that idea. So it's like you look at a thing and you realize it's an interpretation and you have to start asking questions about it. And I guess it doesn't bother me as much as it just bothers me that, and this is the educator coming out, that we don't teach more active, like critical thinking in schools and at home so that, you know, we're realizing that questions always need to be asked of everything we're seeing through media or reading. it seems like not a problem with the art. It seems a problem with maybe the way we look at the art as a culture.
Well, we are out of time. It's always interesting getting a conversation and with the great John Copenhagen and talking about his new book, The Savage Kind. Get it. It's the best book available right now or soon.
Yeah. Next Tuesday. Oh, my goodness. Well,
there you go. Then he won't be doing the show anymore because he'll be really big.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Well, thank you, John.
Thank you guys so much.
Appreciate it.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll tell you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.